Okay, John, before we start this program, I just wanted to address a person who identified themselves as angry customers who wrote in a review, "If you're switching to Mandarin, I'm leaving." So first, thank you, angry customers, for writing a review, and thanks for listening to the show. Let me clarify, we are not switching to Mandarin, and I could have maybe done a better job of explaining this beforehand. We're simply trying to reach out to more people in Taiwan by offering a short Chinese episode every Tuesday, every Thursday, and sometimes Fridays, and even other days of the week, we release English content. Sometime later, you know, maybe the end of the year, we might split the two channels. But, you know, for me personally, offering some of these tales in Chinese is very important. We love our overseas and local English-speaking listeners, but so many Taiwanese people have asked for Chinese episodes, as not everybody can follow our somewhat fast-paced and, you know, also somewhat dense English content. So I hope angry customers and anybody else feeling that way understands. I apologize for any misunderstanding. So again, full English episodes on Thursdays, sometimes Fridays as well, and very short Chinese episodes on Tuesday. Thank you very much.
The Taiwan History Podcast, Formosa Files, is made possible through the generous sponsorship of the Frank C. Chen Foundation. Formosa Files.
From the Sino-Japanese War in the 1930s to the end of the century, Taiwan and China waged a war of words using radio technology. Propaganda, clever or clumsy, rode the radio waves, trying to win hearts and minds, trying to incite or demoralize. Today we're going to look at this invisible battlefield. And John, you recently visited the National Radio Museum, which is in Mingxiong Township, Jiayi County, not far from where you are.
Yes, the museum is in a great old building from the Japanese colonial period, and the building is an actual old radio broadcasting center. Construction began in 1937, and it became operational on September 28th, 1940.
September 28th, okay, that's Teacher's Day or Confucius's birthday. And in 1940, okay, the Japanese are fighting in China, but not yet in the Pacific.
But the Japanese are getting ready for their southern push. The Mingxiong Broadcast Center was used to spread propaganda in Southeast Asia and the coastal areas of southern China. It also delivered secret messages regarding military actions.
It wasn't the first radio broadcasting site in Taiwan. I think that dates back to 1925, somewhere near Taipei.
Yes, so we're talking about broadcasts, actual military radio equipment set up earlier. But yeah, anyway, this Jiayi station was for overseas reach. It had two T-shaped signal towers measuring 206 meters in height. The main building itself is a two-storied building, reinforced concrete and covered with bricks and light colors. It's very much a building from later Japanese rule, the cleaner lines and less fancy brick construction.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Because after the great Kanto earthquake of 1923, which decimated Tokyo, and also there was this Western trend towards simplicity, you start seeing the Japanese building these, you know, stronger, more modern looking buildings.
Yes. Many of the materials and equipment required for this radio center were shipped from Japan. So they arrived at the port of Geelong and then came to Mingxiong by rail. The site was near the railway line for ease of transport, and a temporary branch railway line was put in. And also teams of oxen were used for carrying equipment. After World War II, and surprisingly, it was not hit during the war, the center became a base for psychological warfare broadcasting towards mainland China. And once again, it was sending out programs, propaganda, and secret messages for agents in China.
We talked about some of the programs that were sent out. There was one called Teresa Dung Time. So Teresa Dung was an incredibly popular singer on both sides of the strait. We did a whole episode on her. You should definitely check it out. And for many people in China, in the People's Republic of China, listening to Teresa Dung was their first love affair with modern pop music.
As well as music shows, there were programs with Taiwan news, world news, in-depth programs looking at democracy and problems in China, even satirical dramas.
And for some really direct propaganda, there were radio messages following programs. which involved inviting pilots in the Air Force to defect with their airplanes. And they actually set how much gold you would get as a reward. So you get, you know, 20 bars for a MiG this, or, you know, 15 bars for the... And it worked! There were defectors from China who heard these broadcasts and started thinking, hey, I wouldn't mind having a few bars of gold.
Funny. Eric, you did a two-part episode with Professor Andrew Morris on the subject of defectors flying to Taiwan. Fascinating.
Yeah, it really was. And as well as sending out broadcasts, there was also intercepting broadcast. That stepped up in the early 1970s and lasted all the way through 1998.
The Mingxiang radio station has some great old equipment, the original transmitters, including a Japanese transmitter. And there are three US-made radio transmitters in the broadcasting room. There's a medium wave one. Yeah, one transmitter was used to broadcast to southern China using Fujian and Hakka dialects. And it was in operation for 30 years.
There were also two shortwave transmitters called agent transmitters. They were originally on American battleships, and they were used to send Mandarin broadcasts.
But here's a twist. The broadcasters mimicked mainland accents. So they were pretending to be programs coming out of Shanghai or Shandong stations. The tapes used in broadcasting were recorded in Taipei. Every day, the tapes would come down to Jiayi by train.
So they're pretending to be like official mainland Chinese radio, but in there, they're slipping in some not exactly allowed stuff.
Yes, and in 1999, the Radio Broadcasting Center was opened to the public as the National Radio Museum.
Yeah, I mean, radio used to be really important all over the world, but especially here for pleasure, education, and of course, propaganda work.
Yes, and especially true in Taiwan, because television came relatively late. TV broadcasting started in 1962, Double 10 Day, October 10th, and it was limited to just 4 hours a day.
Yeah, that's pretty late. And I remember from the episode we did on Taiwan in 1958 that there was no TV.
No TV, but there were 55 radio broadcasting stations in operation.
Okay, so just as a review, this booklet from 1958 said, quote, "The largest network is that of the Broadcasting Corporation of China, BCC, whose main station is in Taipei, plus 10 stations scattered throughout the island. Its overseas program, The Voice of Free China, broadcasts to the United States, Northeast and Southeast Asia, and the Middle East in four languages, English, Korean, Japanese, and Arabic, and five Chinese dialects. Mandarin, Cantonese, Swato, Amoy, and Hakka. Broadcast beam to the Chinese mainland, bring a message of hope 14 hours a day to the people there."
And do you remember the most interesting point?
Yeah. A special Russian language broadcast, 10 hours a day, is aimed at Siberia.
Amazing. Russian language broadcast from Taiwan to Siberia. I'd never heard of that before. Incredible. So I did a little bit of research. It turns out that the CIA and the Republic of China worked together for nearly two decades, 1955 to 1973, broadcasting to audiences in the Soviet Union. This was done through Radio Liberty Taiwan.
But the Nationalists, or the KMT, had started alone earlier than that. Back in August of 1950, less than a year after the communist victory, the Chinese nationalist shortwave broadcasting station, The Voice of Free China, was already operational. This was pretty simple. According to author Richard H. Cummings, quote, "The broadcast content was short items of international news, presented straightforwardly without comment. Soviet authorities promptly and effectively jammed the broadcast in the USSR.
Yes, but the CIA-sponsored radio, this Broadcasting Corporation of China, they signed an agreement December 1954, which allowed this American radio, Liberty Radio, to use certain transmitting facilities on Taiwan owned by the corporation. Taiwan provided the land and personnel for the operation and maintenance of the facility. The Americans provided the equipment. And the Americans got to broadcast for 8 hours each day and paid $16.50 an hour for each transmitter provided.
$16.50 is pretty cheap for propaganda work. And these initial broadcasts went on air on shortwave 6 months later, May 1st, 1955, from a transmitter at Banqiao, which used to be on the outskirts of Taipei, but is now pretty much a part of Taipei, technically New Taipei City.
That was a temporary location. They were constructing a facility at Bali.
Bali, so that's right across the river from Danshui, on the coast about 20 kilometers north of Taipei.
The programming from Radio Liberty Taiwan was beamed to the eastern areas of the Soviet Union.
Okay, eastern areas of the Soviet Union, so Siberia.
Yes, and quoting from Richard H. Cummings, quote, "News programs were produced locally, while some feature programs broadcast from Taiwan were flown from Radio Liberty in Munich or New York. The process was time-consuming, so a local program department was established on Taiwan, supplemented by a correspondent in Hong Kong. Eventually, a staff of 16 persons worked for Radio Liberty in Taiwan."
Yeah, it's so easy for us to forget today. You know, you can't email sound to someone back then. Right. You had to bring it on a cassette or whatever, right? The Richard Cummings article appears on the Wilson Center website, and it says Radio Liberty had a monitoring facility in Sapporo on the island of Hokkaido, Japan's northernmost island, to monitor the effectiveness of its broadcasts originating from the site in Taiwan.
For nearly 20 years, Russians in Siberia enjoyed radio broadcasts from Radio Liberty Taiwan Station. But broadcasting stopped December 31st, 1973, due to budget cutbacks. It was the subject of congressional hearings.
Yeah, a Mr. Howland Sargent, he was the head of the Liberty Radio Station, said that there was, quote, "a significant audience in the far eastern part of the Soviet Union. Numerically, it's a small audience, but we were broadcasting to the maritime provinces. Potential audience is on the order of about 20 million, but because of the terrain of the mountains, I think we were reaching an audience of somewhere between 4 and 5 million.
But he thought it was a significant audience because of the location.
Yeah, that's right. He says, quote, "The audience included those that lived in the areas of the Amur and Asari rivers, where the border clashes between the Soviet Union and China took place in 1969, and the same areas, I may say, where the border clashes took place with the Japanese in the middle of the 1930s.
Yeah, the Soviet Union and China almost went to war over those border clashes, so... yeah, the radio broadcasts to those regions might have done some useful work. And just generally, I think that radio broadcasts were a tremendous tool, you know, great reach, very cost effective. And giving people straight news was especially effective, you know, information and you're connecting them to the outside world. Also a means of people learning languages. This is soft power.
Yeah, agreed. And the broadcasting, however, was not a one-way stream. It was flowing in multiple directions because China had propaganda radio stations as well in the region, and they broadcast in English and also in Chinese. But as you might expect, the PRC's version of radio broadcasts were rather heavy-handed and ineffective.
Yeah, here are some examples of this CCP smart power from June of 1971. Broadcast picked up and recorded, then transcribed by listening posts in the region. Eric, you want to read this?
Yeah, okay. So first up, a broadcast in English from Beijing, and it features criticism of American involvement in Taiwan. So it goes like this. U.S. imperialism has insisted on antagonizing 700 million Chinese people and forcibly occupied China's sacred territory, Taiwan province, for 21 years.
Okay, this is the Vietnam War years, and American involvement in the region was pretty intense. For example, Okinawa and the surrounding Ryukyu Islands were still under U.S. administration. They would revert to Japanese rule the following year.
And China radio was, you know, pointing out as much as it could about the U.S. Here's a little bit more from that same broadcast. They say, To strengthen its military occupation and colonial rule in Taiwan, U.S. imperialism has stepped up its collusion with the Chiang Kai-shek bandit gang. Beginning in June of 1970, its military and administrative chiefs have gone frequently to Taiwan for sinister activities. In January and August last year, U.S. Vice President Spiro Agnew sneaked twice into Taiwan to bolster up and reassure the Chiang Kai-shek bandit gang by raving feverishly that the United States pledges to fulfill its treaty obligation to this gang. I don't know, John, this is not effective hyperbole at its best here.
Could use it for a drinking game. Every time you hear bandit or imperialist, you have a sip.
Yeah.
But, oh gosh, he's talking about the American vice president sneaking into Taiwan. No, it was not a secret. Public visits. Yeah, the poor VP at this time, he made several trips. He's reassuring Chiang Kai-shek and the KMT about America sticking with them because, you know, they were looking to switch. And you know what? VP Spiro Agnew, President Nixon, the secret if paranoid man that he was, had not told Spiro Agnew, his vice president, about his plans for China and changing diplomatic relations.
Yeah, ironically, the sinister activity is that the U.S. is looking to switch diplomatic recognition to Beijing.
Right. Just 2 weeks after this broadcast, we have Henry Kissinger's secret trip to Beijing, setting things up for Nixon to visit.
Anyway, this Beijing radio broadcast names more high-level Americans visiting the island, and then we get some hatred directed at Japan, you know, to be expected. U.S. imperialism is stepping up its collusion with the Japanese reactionaries, using the Japanese militarists as the shock force for its aggression on China's Taiwan and other Asian countries.
The broadcast says the U.S. is, quote, working hand in glove covertly with the Japanese reactionaries.
The U.S. and Japanese reactionaries have long been fostering a handful of so-called Taiwan independentists who have headquarters set up in New York and Tokyo. Earlier last year, Peng Mingmin, a pawn of U.S. imperialism and one of the chieftains of the so-called Taiwan independence movement, was smuggled out of Taiwan on a ship to the United States by his master.
Ha! The broadcast says that U.S. military and CIA agents were giving covert support to Taiwan independence supporters, which was incorrect.
Very incorrect, yeah. So the broadcast ends with this promise. The Chinese people are determined to liberate Taiwan.
Ha, liberate my... And more than half a century later, we still get the same threats from the CCP. And yeah, another lifetime leader in office. CCP party members are required to study the thoughts of Xi Jinping.
So many thoughts, yeah. That last broadcast was in English. This next one is from June 27, 1971, and it's a Mandarin Chinese language broadcast. It's from the PLA, the People's Liberation Army, Fujian Front Radio. Fujian, so directly across the Taiwan Strait, broadcast to Taiwan and the offshore islands.
Just note the significance of this June 27th date and earlier the references to 21 years. It's connected to the Korean War. So June 27, 1950, in the words of this radio broadcast, quote, the third day after U.S. imperialism launched a war of aggression against Korea, had forcibly occupied our sacred territory of Taiwan province and the Taiwan Straits.
Yeah. We need to make a list, John, of all the words that they use. Sacred, inalienable, you know. It would be fun. So anyway, the title of this Mandarin Chinese broadcast is Taiwan Compatriots, Patriotic Anti-U.S. Action is Fine.
It's fine.
Yeah. And the message to the people of those islands and also on Taiwan is as follows. The east wind blows like the sound of war drums. Who is afraid of whom in today's world? Countless facts indicate that it is not the masses of the people who are afraid of U.S. imperialism, but the U.S. imperialists who are afraid of the broad masses of the people. So deep. Whoa.
It says that the U.S., although seemingly strong, has become, quote, a rat scurrying across the streets and chased by every passerby. U.S. imperialism, drink, is at the end of its rope. According to this broadcast, their Taiwan compatriots have been fighting resolutely against U.S. imperialism and, quote, achieved one victory after another, end quote.
Which is, I don't know, utter madness?
Yeah, here's more of the same. Quote, the ruthless U.S. control of Taiwan and persecution of the Taiwanese, of the Taiwan compatriots over the past 21 years, have roused the broad masses to unite as one to oppose U.S. imperialism.
Yeah, it's pretty much insanity to suggest the masses of Taiwan have been waging an unremitting struggle against U.S. imperialist aggression and the dark rule of the Chiang Kai-shek gang. I mean, there was some protests, you know, not everybody was happy with Chiang Kai-shek, but not anything like that.
Yes. So after North Korea invaded the South in 1950, you had the Americans stepping in to help Taiwan. And after that, you know, wow, what tremendous help. They provided a lot of much needed aid, helped develop the country. They restrained KMT excesses. The wonderful land reform program was bankrolled by U.S. money. Yeah, it's something the mainland Chinese would have liked themselves.
Yeah, we're not negating the fact that there were many Taiwanese who were extremely unhappy, right, with the new rulers of Taiwan. You have the, you know, all that stuff from 228 that's continuing. But at that time, at that, you know, exact time around the mid-50s, late-50s, the examples of Taiwanese rising up against American rule, well, I'm thinking of what? The 1957 riot, the sacking of the U.S. embassy?
We covered that story in season one of Formosa Files.
Yeah. And the communist Chinese version of those events is, quote, an innocent Chinese was slaughtered by U.S. aggressors on the 24th of May, 1957. Enraged by this incident, the Taiwan compatriots staged a mammoth anti-U.S. demonstration. The U.S. embassy in Taiwan was destroyed, and the U.S. flag there was torn into pieces. The slogan, U.S. aggressors, get out of Taiwan, resounded throughout the island. The Taiwan compatriots' struggle against U.S. imperialism has mounted with each passing day since this incident.
Wow, that death of the Chinese man was probably self-defense. Details are a bit murky. Also, who was behind the riot at the embassy? That embassy riot, the fallout from it, blew over pretty quickly. And this propaganda broadcast from China we're reading from, it's from 1971 when the plotting is the Americans looking to get friendlier with the commies.
Yeah, irony. So here's the radio broadcast continuing. And it says, inspired by the motherland's great proletarian cultural revolution. You know, they're talking about the Cultural Revolution, which kind of was a major disaster. The Taiwan compatriots have made new progress in fighting against U.S. imperialist aggression. Some 7,000 peasants from the Fengshan area of Kaohsiung successfully waged a dauntless struggle against the plot of the U.S. Zhang clique to take over the land by force between March and April 1967.
I've never heard of that. It must have been a storm in a teacup.
Yeah, 67, that would be during the time Chen Shih-chuan, Frank C. Chen, was the mayor. And from what we've seen, it just seems to be a protest over like a business zone or an export zone or some, you know, a reasonable thing that happened.
And not a peasant uprising or even mainly peasant.
And certainly not violent in a serious way.
Yes, but apparently it's part of an uprising, quote, encouraged by our great leader Chairman Mao's solemn statement, people of the world unite and defeat the U.S. aggressors and all their running dogs. A new upsurge in the Taiwan compatriots' anti-U.S. struggle has taken shape since 1970.
I still love the phrase running dogs. It's one of my favorite. Most of this broadcast is pretty much nonsense. But there were some violent actions that did occur in Taiwan in the early 1970s, and the radio broadcast references them like this. A large bomb exploded at the USIS library in Taiwan on October 12, 1970. Second lieutenant of the Zhang Air Force and three others barely escaped with their lives.
Yes, seems correct. Early evening, a large explosion in the lobby of the USIS. That's United States Information Service, basically a library. A bomb went off. A janitor was slightly injured and three seriously injured.
And the Chinese cite another bit of violence in their broadcast. The Taipei branch of the Bank of America was bombed on February 5th, 1971, and 16 persons, including two U.S. aggressors, were wounded.
I think that number is correct, yes.
Okay, continuing with the Chinese broadcast, many other incidents causing great rejoicing to the people have occurred in Taiwan, including the destruction of U.S. vehicles, seizure of weapons, cutting of telephone lines, destruction of gasoline pipelines, and beatings and killings of U.S. military and administrative personnel in Taiwan.
Oh, nonsense for the most part. I've read of a few cases of firebombing of cars owned by U.S. personnel in 1970.
Okay, this part is one of my favorites. The radio broadcast says, posters bearing propaganda slogans such as Long Live Chairman Mao and Long Live the Communist Party of China and Taiwan is China's Taiwan and U.S. aggressors get out of Taiwan have appeared everywhere. Yeah, in your dreams.
Yeah, fantasy. Or rather cliched and dull, delusional and dull at the same time. I can't imagine there were many listeners.
Oh, no, no, no. Quite the opposite, my imperialist running dog co-host. Let me quote from the Chinese radio broadcast. Taiwan compatriots, despite the strict control of U.S. Zhang special agents, use all possible means to listen to Peking broadcasts at the risk of their lives in connection with their efforts to carry out the patriotic anti-U.S. struggle.
But those listeners need not hide in fear for much longer, because the freedom of communism is coming soon. The broadcast says, quote, the situation is splendid. We deeply believe that under the guidance of Mao Zedong thought, the Taiwanese and Chinese are going to drive the U.S. aggressors out of Taiwan and the Taiwan Straits so that the brilliant sun of Mao Zedong can illuminate every part of Taiwan.
Aww, so nice, yeah. Okay, well, we don't have much more time here, so we're going to wrap it up. But John, we should clarify that there were definitely people in Taiwan all the way from the second that the Nationalists landed through the 70s up until democracy came who were opposed to the government, and some of them did commit violent actions because they were either pro-Taiwan independence, pro-democracy, or pro-something. So there was certainly, you know, some strife that occurred, but not this ridiculous propaganda stuff.
Yes, we could do an episode on domestic political violence.
Yeah, and I think we will. Okay, folks, thanks for listening to Formosa Files, English version. I'm Eric Michael Smith.
I'm an imperialist running dog. I'm John Ross. Bye.